dismiss, and we will go on to case number two, which is Appeal 02-3500, Robert Fate versus Albert Hummel. Mr. Ashman?
Yes, Your Honor.
Good morning, Mr. Ashman.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm Kenneth J. Ashman of Ashman Law Offices, LLC, and along with my co-counsel, Jerry M. Stein of Ashman & Stein, I represent plaintiff appellant in this appeal. Does a corporate director voting in favor of a self-dealing transaction to issue shares of common stock at a fixed price have a duty to know whether such price reflects market value? Now, especially when the issuance of such shares will significantly dilute the voting power of the common shareholders and change corporate control from the common shareholders to a select group of preferred shareholders of which one half of the board is a member. Now, if the answer to that question is yes, in other words, if there is such a duty that the disinterested directors know the market value of the shares that they authorized to issue, then the district court committed reversible error.
What was the market value?
The market value was somewhere greater than $1.
What was it?
Well, according to the witness, the deposition witness who was submitted in connection with the trial below as part of deposition testimony, John Curran, he said that it didn't make a difference to him what the actual value was for the market value per share. He was making a $200,000 investment. It didn't make a difference to him whether he was going to get 20,000 shares at $10 a share or 200,000 shares at $1 a share.
But all you're saying is that he then was not testifying about the market value per share. You're not saying that an appropriate financial expert could have evaluated the books of the corporation at the relevant time and come up with a number. And there seems to be no evidence in this record other than the evidence that the district court credited, which was that a dollar a share was actually a pretty good price for this struggling company at that time. I mean, I'm a little surprised that you didn't, you know, whoever was representing your client at the time, didn't at least make a stab at saying, you know, it's $1.50 a share, it's $2 a share, it's something. You know, for you to vaguely say more than one doesn't have any concreteness to it.
Well, I mean, if you're looking, what the district court found in determining that the dollar per share was fair, the district court did not take a look at what the market value was.
But there was the evidence in front of the district court judge, and this is after all after a trial, was that this company was nearly bankrupt. Mm-hmm. The actual value might have been 5 cents a share, and so the fact that they were willing to call it a dollar a share, if the simple task you've put before yourself is to ask whether a dollar a share is a fair price, if disinterested directors could so have concluded,
Kirby, why couldn't the directors have reasonably concluded that this offering was, you know, a necessary, prudent way for the company to raise the cash that it needed to stay afloat? I mean, there was considerable evidence that Pentec was just about out of money, you know, at the time of the stock offering.
Because I think you need to look at the kind of the big, true picture of what occurred. What happened here was there was alternate aspects or routes to go to getting additional funds.
But that doesn't go to the question whether this was a bad price per share. Mm-hmm. You've tried to say two things. One, that it's impossible to evaluate these shares, in which case I'm not sure that the inference should be that the dollar was a bad price as opposed to a good one. Or, I mean, I don't know.
The duty on the director's part was to maximize the amount per share. They didn't do that. They didn't.
How do they know? The district court thought that they knew that and that they did maximize the amount per share.
You've pointed out that Miles and Monson got much of their information about the stock offering from Lumsden and Hummel.
Correct.
Well, is there evidence in the record that the information that Lumsden and Hummel conveyed to them was inaccurate or misleading?
Yes, there's actually, I'd like to respond to that in two ways. The first way is that whatever information they receive, that information is tainted. The point of the statute of 8.60 of under the Illinois statute, the is that a transaction that is has self-interest in it, self-dealing, can be proper and approved if it's fair, but there's a check and a balance on that, and the check is that disinterested directors with full knowledge of all the facts and knowledge of the interested transaction will oversee it and vote for it. If the information that those disinterested directors receive is solely from the interested directors, they're acting effectively as a proxy with respect to the knowledge of whether they've obtained no independent knowledge. So the first issue is, the first way to answer that question is that the mere fact that they relied solely upon that is error of itself, regardless of whether that is somehow accurate or inaccurate, because there's nothing in the record that suggests that what was conveyed was totally accurate. In fact, the evidence shows otherwise. Lumsden, a purported, if you accept what Miles and Bronson are saying, they're saying that they received accurate information as to the reason why they had to issue these shares at a dollar per share.
But of course, you're making a factual assumption that the district court didn't buy. She, in discussing Miles, for instance, has a number of findings suggesting that he did have independent knowledge of the industry. He attended meetings. It's not that Lumsden was there filtering everything to him. Now, if we had that case, we'd have to consider that case. But her findings, at least, which I suppose you're arguing are clearly erroneous, are that Miles had substantial independent knowledge.
He was a pharmaceutical consultant, was he not?
He was, but it had nothing to do with financial aspects of consulting. His knowledge base with respect to pharmaceuticals was in sales and things along those lines. It had nothing to do with financial or valuation issues, for example. He had no expertise in that regard. But I just wanted to return to the question. I didn't want to leave it hanging there. And Lumsden apparently, according to Miles and Bronson, had apparently conveyed to them the reason why we had to go with this dollar per share and there was no other alternatives, etc. But we know from the evidence that Lumsden had a whole secret plan to dilute the common shareholders. That's absolutely 100% documented. So if the information that is being received by Miles and Ronson did not include that information, well, then they were being misled as to the true purpose of the transaction. And therefore, what was communicated by Lumsden to Miles and Hummel, as a matter of fact, was inaccurate, aside from the legal standard that it's just inappropriate to rely on that. With respect to the question about, I forgot what your...
No, I was just saying that I suppose you're saying that it's clearly erroneous, and also, I'm looking at the district court's opinion right now, where the court comments that you did not cite, at least at that stage, any legal authority for what she calls your questionable argument that directors lacking expertise on a particular subject must seek advice from independent experts, which I think goes back to what Judge Rovner was saying. If they weren't conveying inaccurate information, and we have the record now, you know, the company was really solvent and they were saying it wasn't, or, you know, something like that, then where do you get this rule from?
Well, if you think about the purpose of the statute, I mean,
you actually have to make up a new rule of Illinois law.
Well, there's very little jurisprudence interpreting this exact statute. There's just not a lot of case law arises under it. So we have to take a look at, you know, what is the scope, what was the scheme, the statutory scheme, which is based upon the common law scheme.
I take this as a yes from you to my question. You're asking us to make up a new rule of Illinois law.
I don't think it's a new rule, Your Honor.
It's not out there. No court has ever held it, told me.
Well, what I'm saying is that it's the existing rule that a court would recognized. I'm not suggesting that it changes anything. All I'm suggesting is that now it's being brought forth as an issue, and the court will recognize what is practice and what is the legislative intent. But you can derive that from the common law. I mean, look, originally the common law said these kinds of transactions, self-dealing transactions, are inappropriate, period, even if they're fair.
No, I understand that, but I hate to bash on this, but the fact is, if no Illinois court has ever adopted the legal proposition that you are asking us to derive from the statutory language, then A, what we're doing is new. Maybe it's correct, maybe it isn't, but it's new. And B, the question for us is, faced with this new question, what would an Illinois court do? How have other states looked at it? How does it fit in with the broader body of Illinois law? What clues do we have for thinking that the Illinois courts would go the way you want us to go? And that's the way one handles these questions. We don't just sort of sit there and say, well, we think this is the smart way to do it, even though that would be nice sometimes, but you actually have to jump through the hoops.
Sometimes we even have to certify questions. Are you suggesting that this is something that ought to be certified to the Illinois Supreme Court?
I'm not, Your Honor, because the statutory scheme does not say that a self-interested director can approve a transaction absent the vote and the approval of a knowledgeable disinterested director. If that's the scheme, that an interested director cannot do that, well then, if the disinterested director are receiving all of their information from the interested director, there is no difference between the interested director making that vote or the disinterested director making the vote when that knowledge base comes solely from a tainted source.
Well, but let's look at this case for a minute, because, look, there's no question that you've certainly pointed out ways in which Mr. Miles and Mr. Ronson could have known more about the stock offering than they did. But these directors seem to have been in a position to know about the value of Pentok and what its prospects were. Miles was a pharmaceutical consultant. I don't, you know, you've explained that he was in sales, but right. Looking at the record as we would, he was a pharmaceutical consultant. And Ronson was Pentok's senior vice president. So even if they lacked an independent expert assessment of what Pentok stock was worth, weren't they sufficiently equipped to know whether the dollar per share price was a reasonable one?
No, I don't think so, Your Honor. First, I want to make a correction. I looked in my notes. Miles was in the area of, quote, compliance, quality assurance, and operations.
But look, Miles wasn't running a golf product store, or he wasn't a veterinarian. He was in the business, and the district court finds as a fact that he and Ronson were sufficiently well-informed, and you aren't really challenging her findings of fact about what they did know. You're saying that somehow we should derive from the law some higher burden of either quality of information that goes into the decision for the disinterested directors or some deeper level of knowledge, and she says, you never cite her anything that says the findings of fact that she made weren't based on the right legal standard, and I don't really see it here either, other than your inferential argument from the statute. These people were in the business, they probably had a good sense of the business. She finds that, and I don't see you arguing if that's clearly erroneous.
Your Honor, what I'm looking at here is the language of 8.60. It says that you have to have knowledge of material facts of the transaction. It doesn't say that you have to have knowledge of the general company, the general operations of the company. It's of this particular transaction. The transaction was the issuance of 4.2 million shares at $1 per share. What the directors needed to know was, of those components, 4.2 million and $1 per share. And no reasonable, if you take a look at the materiality standard under the securities laws, the issue there is, would a reasonable, in the proxy solicitation context, for example, would a reasonable shareholder want to know this information and make an informed vote? And applying that standard here, a materiality standard here, the question is, would a director want to know this information, i.e. market value information, in making a vote to approve to sell the shares at $1 per share? And I think any reasonable director would say, hey, is $1 per share the most we can get? Is that something that is fair to our company? In fact, Illinois law mandates that it happens in a self-dealing.
Where is the evidence that more than $1 a share was available anyway?
Well, the burden rests with...
That's the problem here, I think.
Yeah. Well, the burden rests with those who are undertaking the self-dealing transaction to establish that it's fair. They only get out of that burden if they're able to show that the disinterested directors had knowledge of all the material facts of that transaction and that that they knew of the conflict of interest. And here, the disinterested directors did not have knowledge of all the material facts of the transaction, because a primary basic material fact is this dollar per share what the market can bear? And there's no question in the record that neither Miles nor Bronson knew that. They just simply did not know whether the dollar per share was what the market value was. Absent them knowing that that is what the market value is, the burden resided with the defendant to show that the transaction was fair. I see that my time is up, and I'll save the rest for rebuttal. Thank you.
Mr. Macy, good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, Eric Macy with Novak and Macy on behalf of the appellees, defendants below. With me is my colleague Shelby Drury at counsel table. Your Honors, I would urge you to affirm Judge Conlon's opinion and the judgment in favor of the defendants and against the plaintiffs.
Would you tell me this, please? Is it true that Mr. Ronson essentially admitted that he did not understand the mechanics of the stock offering and its dilutive effects, and would he, if it is, would his ignorance about such details call into question the adequacy of his knowledge for purposes of Section 8.60?
Yes. First, the record reflects that Mr. Ronson had questions concerning his knowledge and understanding as to the actual dilutive effects of the stock offering. Would it affect the application of Section 8.6? Absolutely not. And here's why. Knowledge isn't the issue here today. The issue is fairness, because irrespective of whether the burden was on the defendant, and let's assume for argument here, despite what Judge Conlon held, that the burden was with the plaintiff, but that the burden of fairness was with the defendant, the defendants demonstrated by a preponderance of the evidence that the stock offering was fair. It put on two expert witnesses that she found credible and convincing. They demonstrated what the market value, not the liquidation value of the corporation was, as of the time frame of the offering, which was the March-April 2001 time frame. They demonstrated that market value was between $14 and $16 million, that the preferred shareholders had an interest, an economic interest in the corporation of $19 at that time, and therefore the value of the common stock, based on the expert testimony, was effectively de minimis, if not zero, and therefore an offering of $1 was substantially in excess of what the commons could otherwise get in the market, which is the test. And the commons, indeed, by reason of the offering, were prevented from seeing no value in their stock, because their equity would have been zero if this company, that as of that time had $93,000 of cash, over $1.5 million of then current liability, no marketable products, went belly up. So the offering was imminently fair, and as Your Honor held recently in your Cohen decision that came out, that the standard of review of clear and convincing evidence for a finding of the facts under Rule 52A for the factual determinations by Judge Conlon, and indeed the application of facts to law, as Your Honor held in the Cohen case, Judge Rovner, was likewise was likewise a clear and convincing
Of course.
And with all due respect to counsel, what I see in the argument and the brief is that the concern here is that a disagreement with what Judge Conlon found as to the facts and the application of the facts to existing law. And therefore, the standard is clear and convincing. And there's nothing in the record that has been demonstrated that the findings by Judge Conlon, particularly with respect to the expert testimony presented by the defendants in their case in chief, was not clear and convincing. So if the transaction is fair, a fortiori, it does not matter who had the burden, even if we otherwise had the burden, to prove fairness, we did below.
Well, of course, it seems to me the math that Mr. Ashman is inviting us to engage in suggests that had they issued 2.1 million shares instead of 4.2 million, then the shares would have been $2 a piece in the market and so on, going down that line, right up to issuing one new share, I guess, at $4.2 million.
Well, sure. That's a wonderful hypothetical. I guess you could have issued half the shares and tried to sell them at $50 a share. But if they didn't sell, you didn't get your money and the company went belly up. And that's what goes to the fairness test. And so the point is that the evidence at the trial below by the experts demonstrated that the dollar per share offering was eminently fair. And I would suggest to the court that what counsel would like the court to do and what the director should not be able to have to do is that, let's take this, startup company, fully capitalized, not marketing product, and a severe cash crunch that if not rectified within a short period of time can't even make their payroll and have to go belly up. The suggestion is that these independent directors at that point in time must stop, use their precious cash, their $93,000, which they need for operations, go out, hire Bear Stearns or some other investment banker or a valuation expert, spend tons of money with a huge time gap to come back and get a fairness opinion for the stock offering. I'm unaware of any case in Illinois that requires before a corporation offers stock, particularly a closed corporation, not publicly traded, must go out and get a fairness opinion before it offers the stock. Now, particularly under circumstances like this, which will strangle boards to effect raising capital for corporations to permit the company to move forward.
Mr. Fink has suggested that the real purpose of the stock offering was to wrest control of the company away from himself and Mr. El-Rashidi. Does the record tell us how the board decided the number of common shares to offer?
Yes, it does. The record tells you that the board only had X amount of common stock that was issued but not outstanding. The record also reflects that Mr. Hummel, the president of the company, had a meeting with employees of the corporation who had stock options to please give those stock options back up to the corporation as common stock so they would have more common stock that they could issue to generate even more cash. Indeed, one of the independent directors, who was not a defendant, Mr. Ronson, had such stock options, and he knowingly gave up his options back to the corporation so that the corporation could sell that as part of the common stock to raise more cash. That was the purpose of what happened here. Dr. El-Rashidi and Dr. Fate knew that as a result of the 1998 Investors Rights Agreement, pursuant to which the Series A or preferred shareholders invested their $15 million as preferred stock, gave those Series A shareholders in that agreement, signed by Mr. Fate, signed by Dr. El-Rashidi and the corporation, the express right of a first refusal. They always knew that. And indeed, the record reflects that in the summer of that same year, 1998, the articles of incorporation of the company were amended such that the Series A's, the preferred shareholders, had a right, a veto, to preclude the corporation from bringing in capital through equity that would be either superior to the Series A's or even para passu. So the board was stuck. It was stuck by the very agreement that Dr. Fate and Dr. El-Rashidi entered into in 1998. And as we indicate in our brief, what we believe the case is about was a concern by a common shareholder who, when the venture capital came in and put in the real money, the $15 million, several years later, didn't like the deal that was cut. But that was the deal. Everybody knew the deal. Dr. Fate knew the deal, and all the members of the directors knew the deal. They had that knowledge. They couldn't just permit other equity to come in that would be senior to the Series A preferred or pari passu. They needed the seniors to agree to it. The seniors said no. So the board is stuck. The board had knowledge. The transaction was fair. Now, the other point I would like to talk about is the knowledge point, if the judges are concerned about where the burden lied on the burden of proof. And I believe Judge Conlon made clear in her findings of fact, and I think the key point is what the statute says, what Section 8.6 of the Business Corporation Act. The statute talks about knowledge of the material fact of the transaction. And these two directors expressly had that knowledge. What did they know? They clearly knew of the company's cash crunch. They clearly knew of the stage of development of these products and that they could not be actively sold in the marketplace currently to generate the kind of revenue they needed. They clearly knew that the company was engaged in severe litigation with GlaxoSmithKline, challenging the most valuable patent in the court downstairs before Judge Manning that was taking millions of dollars of the company's cash. They clearly knew that the corporation, by its prior common owners, had already sued directors of the corporation. They clearly knew the status of product development. They clearly knew that the Series of A's had the right of first refusal under the investment rights agreement and the ability to say no under the articles of the corporation for new equity that was either senior or pari passu. They knew that they were selling 4.2 million shares at $1 a share. They knew all the material facts. The judge so held. There is no clear and convincing evidence to the contrary. And for that reason, the judge should be affirmed, finding that the burden of proof as to fairness shifted under Section 8.6 to the plaintiff, and the plaintiff failed to meet that. In conclusion, irrespective of where that burden does lie, the evidence was clear that the value of the corporation justified the offering of stock at $1 per share. There is no clear and convincing evidence to the contrary. There is no evidence that the stock was worth more than $1 at all. And for that reason, we urge the court to affirm Judge Conlon's decision. And unless the court has any other questions, I will finish.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Ashman has 4 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Interesting that out of the long litany of things that the disinterested directors did know, was not included the market value of the shares at $1 per share. It's effectively conceded that they did not know whether $1 per share reflected the market value or not. Now, taking the point that the fairness of the transaction is what truly is at issue, because even if the burden had rested with the defendants, they had established that it was fair. The according to what the district court held, that the value of the interest of the common shareholders in the company was essentially de minimis. And as a result, any amount above zero would have been deemed fair. That's not what the standard holds. That's not what the law under Illinois mandates. The law mandates that the directors in charge of a corporation that's engaging in a self-dealing transaction maximize the value per share for the company, that they get full value. What a defense counsel suggests that he knows of no law or no rule in any jurisdiction in which a company, particularly a close company, needs to engage an investment banker before issuing shares is correct. He's right about that, but not when it comes to a self-dealing transaction. When it comes to a self-dealing transaction, things change. The burden on the disinterested directors becomes heightened. They must know of the material facts all the material facts of that transaction. And it's very hard-pressed to say that any director would not know whether the price they were offering their shares reflected market value when jurisprudence in Illinois, going back over 100 years, suggests that they are under the obligation to maximize that value. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Mr. Ashman. Thank you, Mr. Macy. And the case to be taken under advisement.